you have a cell phone, you might want to turn it down now so it doesn't distract us. Speaking of cell phones, right before we began, Nicole Zembrowski wrote a message that everybody there is sick, and so they're not coming here to get everybody here sick. But other than that, she didn't really say what it was. But she wanted to let us know. You may recall that we are in the book of Exodus. We only went in one chapter last week. We got through chapter 1. Let me say this. Verse 15, Exodus 1, 15. The king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah, and the other whose name was Puah. And he said, when you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth, and you see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, then you shall put him to death. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. Okay, we have two words in here, or two ideas, that I want us to focus on for a minute. Number one, midwife. Number two, killing a baby. The third idea would be the government requiring the midwife to kill the baby. Does that ring a bell with anybody? Right now, in this state, if you want to be a licensed, certified midwife to work in New York State, you have to sign a paper that says you will perform an abortion. And if you don't sign that paper, then you cannot do a whole bunch of things, which is one reason why Marcy and I had our children in the hospital and not at home, because we couldn't find a midwife. Actually, we could find a midwife who would do it, but we would put her in a position where she was working illegally. But the point is this. Not much has changed, has it? The applications. Our God is still our God. He still has the same rules for the most part. And people, governments, people are still creating the same dilemmas, if you will, for God-fearing people. Okay, chapter 2, verse 1. What we have in this section is an introduction to God's servant. Now, a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that, and my version says, when she saw that he was beautiful. The New King James says the same thing. This is after the Septuagint, which says the same thing. The Hebrew says good. The ESV and the NIV say fine. The New English Translation says healthy. And Acts 7, verse 20, Peter says lovely in the sight of the Lord. Because it would be kind of odd. I don't know what mother doesn't think their son is the most beautiful. I don't know what's going on here. But in Acts 20, or in Acts chapter 7, verse 20, Stephen, thank you, says, she saw that the child was lovely in the sight of the Lord. So all I can say is there seems to be something more than his physical looks going on, but I don't know what more. I know almost all babies come out screaming. So the woman conceived and bore a son. She saw he was beautiful. She hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it over with tar and pitch. Okay, here's the joke for you. Has anybody ever heard of the ark that Moses was in? Right. The response is, Moses wasn't in an ark. Noah was. But if you use the New King James, then Moses was in an ark also, because that's the word that's used here. So just be aware of that one for you. Now, she put the child into it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. His sister, Miriam, who is older than he is, Aaron is 3 years older than he is, still, so he's here too somewhere, stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile, with her maidens walking alongside the Nile. This might be, it probably actually is, a religious rite that's going on. Where there were places that are close to temples, where the Nile, where any river really ran close to a temple, they always associated fertility rites, among other things, with the river and the temple. And they would actually have an area, if you go to a swimming place, you'll see where there's an area roped off for people to swim in. Well, here they would have an area where the alligators were kept out. So they would come in, probably not bathing as we think of somebody going in and taking a bath. Okay. So she sees the boy, and behold, the boy was crying, and she had pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from among the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?" Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go ahead." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away, nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So here the mother is being paid to nurse her own child with the condition that she knows this child is going to be taken away from her at some time. By the way, there's nothing better, more nurturing than having the child being fed by the own mother, its own mother. Okay, so the woman took the child and nursed him. The child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. Okay, this word can be translated, the child became great, and the idea would be getting a little bit older. We don't really know how old the child was when given to Pharaoh's daughter. We don't really have any idea. He became her son. She adopted him. And she named him Moses and said, "Because I drew him up out of the water." Okay, something that's going on here. You need to turn to Acts chapter 7. Stephen gives the inspired additional commentary on what happened here. So you might want to keep your finger in Acts chapter 7 because we'll turn there again. Well, verse 20, it was at this time Moses was born. He was lovely in the sight of God. He was nurtured 3 months in his father's home. And after he had been set outside, Pharaoh's daughter came and took him away and nurtured him as her own son. Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians. And he was a man of power in words and deeds. Okay. Being learned in all of the knowledge of the Egyptians. What's it say? The learning of the Egyptians. He would have learned mathematics. He would have learned theology. He would have learned, I mean, other people have studied these things, and what would this Pharaoh's son, essentially, Pharaoh's grandson adopted, would have learned. He would have learned, among other things, how to write. Not everybody back then could write, especially in the Egyptian language. Now, this is interesting. Here he is. He's trained up as a young man to learn how to write, and what will he go on to do? Right. Not only the first five books of the Bible, but also some of the Psalms. At the same time, what we have in the book of Hebrews, you remember, in Hebrews chapter 11, you remember the mother and the father, when they see this baby, they hide this baby. Why did they hide this baby? Do you remember from Hebrews 11 what was behind their hiding the baby? Hebrews 11, verse 23, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden. That was passive. Moses didn't have the faith when he was born to be hidden. His parents had the faith. Okay, so here are, and what does it go on to say? Because they saw that he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. Here you have some parents that are faithful parents. Now, one thing we know, later on in Moses' life, that the very next thing we read of, he's going out to see his brethren. How did he know that they were his brethren? I don't know, but I suspect that if he was in his parents' house long enough, they were teaching him. We can't know that for sure, but we do know one proverb that says, "Train up a child in the way they should go, and when they get old, they will not depart from it." Now, it is a proverb. It doesn't work 100% every time, but that is the general truth here. That may be what's going on. Introducing God's servant. What we see so far is that he is knowledgeable, not only in the learning of the Egyptians, but in God and the things that he has been, that his nation has been promised years ago. Because we see in the next verse, chapter 2, verse 11, it came about in those days when Moses had grown up that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors. So he knows. He's got some kind of spiritual education going on here. It came about in those days. This is 40 years later according to the book of Acts. So he's now 40 years old. Moses goes out and he went out to his brethren. I get the idea of somewhat of the college guy who goes off and gets a big fancy education and comes back to the little podunk town where nobody else ever had an education there. And he comes back and he hasn't forgotten his roots. Those are the kind of people that we like. Moses grew up in the palace or nearby or something, learned all this, but yet where does he go back to? His children. A side lesson would be don't ever forget who you are if you're a Christian. Never forget that you're a Christian. He went out to his brethren, looked on their hard labors. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, and when he saw there was no one around, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. What would you call this action?
Very unwise.
Unwise? Anybody else? I'd call it murder. Stephen calls it vengeance. That's the word Stephen will use in Acts chapter 7. In fact, turn to Acts chapter 7. If you kept your finger there, you were a smarter person than I am. Or wiser. Okay. Verse 23. When he was approaching the age of 40, it entered his mind to visit his brethren. This seems to indicate that he had not been visiting his brethren. I can't say that for sure, but it entered his mind when he was 40. Okay, that seems to be a little different. So, when he saw one of them being treated unjustly, he defended him and took vengeance for the oppressed by striking down the Egyptian. And he supposed... And he supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him, but they did not understand. On the following day, he appeared to them as they were fighting together. And he tried to reconcile them in peace, saying, men, you are brethren. Why do you injure one another? They're acting like an Egyptian and an Israelite instead of two Israelites. And he goes out and says, what are you doing? But the one who was injuring his neighbor pushed him away, saying, who made you a ruler and a judge over us? You do not mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday. Do you? Now turn back to Exodus 2, verse 14. Then Moses was afraid and said, surely the matter has become known. When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Okay, Midian is to the east. Later on, it will say the land of Cush, or his wife is a Cushite, okay? So there's he's going out to the east. First of all, don't miss this. There is it's a joke, and I don't like to use God's name in a joke. Let me tell you what the joke is about. There's an atheist and an old lady. They're neighbors. And the atheist is always saying, why do you believe in God? And the old lady says, because he always provides for me. My God loves me, he provides for me. And the atheist says, your God isn't providing for you. You go out and you work and you get money and you pay for it. And she says, God's providing for me. And so finally he says, one day, I'm going to trick her. So he goes out to the grocery store, buys a whole bunch of groceries, runs, puts them on her porch, rings the doorbell, runs away. And he hides behind the tree and looks. And she comes out and there's groceries on the doorstep. And she says, thank you, God, for providing these groceries. He jumps out from behind the tree. It wasn't God. It was me. I did it. And she says, and praise God, you used an atheist to do it. Okay. God does work that way. And we see that right here with Moses. Here we have this pagan Egyptian guy who thinks he's a god. His daughter is raising up Moses. So we have this pagan using his resources to raise up God's child. God can do that. So the point is, don't think you can get away from God. He has the power and the wisdom to do whatever he wants. Now, I actually backtracked a little bit for that. To catch up here, Moses runs away. A couple more things about Moses. Comment or question, please raise your hand. Yes, sir.
He's already got this assignment through and screwed up. He really is going to take God to get it figured out.
Moses.
Yeah.
Gary?
Just a couple points on him probably likely being trained by his parents. He knew about circumcision. Somehow he was taught that. Okay? And in Acts chapter 7, he already referred to this, when he says that he supposed his brethren understand that God would deliver them by his hand. Is it likely that his parents likely taught him that God will visit his people and bring them back at some point?
Yeah, I don't know if it's his parents. Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. I just can't say for sure. But yeah, I mean, obviously his parents are faithful people, and Moses knows. Faithful people, Moses knows. You know, I don't want to say for sure, but I would be foolish to say not. Sorry?
He was trained.
Oh, yeah, he knows. He knows who his people are and the law that they have and what God is going to do. He goes even so far as to think that he's the one that's going to do it. You know, so yeah, no doubt he's familiar. Was it his parents? Probably, but
this translation has an interesting take on that. It says, "After take this child away and suckle it for me, I will see you are faithful." So the woman took the child and suckled it, and when the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, who treated him like a son and named him Moses, because she said, "I drew him out of the water." Well, if you just back up a little bit and think. The child that is, the woman who gives suck to a baby teaches it a lot. It's its foundation. And if he was being weaned, if he was being instructed by his own real mother, then he would have had a very Hebrew take on it.
Yes. Yeah, that's what, right, no doubt about that. The question is, how old was he when he was delivered over to Pharaoh? And actually, it doesn't matter, because even if he was a month old, which he's not, he was at least 3 months and then some, he still learned.
Yeah. When he had grown up.
Right. And there's that guy went a little far in his, yeah. And I'm no Hebrew scholar, but I've got some other people that are. Okay. So we have this willing to, he's willing to act on his faith. In Acts chapter 7, we see this guy. He says they would suppose he was the one to deliver them. So he's got some kind of knowledge, and he's acting on it. He also has a basic understanding of morality. You are brethren. You should not act that way. Okay? And then, also, Hebrews chapter 11. Have we been there yet? Thanks for telling me that. Hebrews chapter 11. Yeah, we have. Verse 23. Moses. Somebody failed the test. Okay, so Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months. By verse 24, by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproaches of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. He's willing to give up earthly riches for heavenly riches. And then he has perspective. Verse 27, by faith he left Egypt. I'm getting a little ahead, but by faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. That is the key to life. We get so caught up in now, in here. But Moses, when he was living now and here, he didn't think of now and here only. He saw things that he couldn't see, and that's the key to life. Now, back here in Exodus chapter 2, Pharaoh comes along. I'm sorry, Pharaoh doesn't come along. Verse 16, the priest of Midian had 7 daughters. Quick side note, this priest, his name is Reuel. Or Jethro. Okay, he is a priest. Like, there's another priest we know of, Melchizedek. They're around. So it's not that God was like gone and that his representatives were non-existent. We just don't have much record of it.
He didn't leave the Ishmaelites. That's who they are.
God did not leave.
Yeah, God did not leave them. He
right.
Not like, that's it,
you guys, see you later.
That's it, you're gone. You're
right, these are the chosen people, you're not.
Priest right in the midst of it.
Right. Yeah, excellent point. Yeah, God has not left the world. All we have is a record of a special nation. God is out there, we just don't have the record of it so much. He had 7 daughters. They came to the water, to draw water, filled the troughs to the water to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away. Not nice people, especially beating up on women. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. We have three things here. He is a kind man. He is a courageous man. He's fighting off these shepherds who are bullying up the women. And then he helps them. In fact, when they go back, they report to their father, "Why have you come back so soon?" Verse 19, they said, "An Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds. And what is more, he even drew the water for us and watered the flock." This is a man who's willing to serve other people. He's not only standing up there being macho and saying, "Let me save the ladies," but then he's going on and serving them. He said to his daughters, "Where is he then? You silly people, why didn't you bring this guy home?" Ladies, beware. Okay, but why is it that you have left the man behind? Invite him to have something to eat. Moses was willing to dwell with the man, and he gave him his daughter Zipporah, whose name means, I believe, bird, something like that. Little bird, I think, is what the name means. Then she gave birth to a son, and he named him Gershom, for he said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land." Understand this. By this time, he has already rejected Egypt and all of its pleasures. So when he's away in a different land, what is he thinking about? He's not thinking about the Egyptians back there. He's thinking about the Israelites back there. He is mindful of his people, even though he's gone. Out of sight, but not out of mind. And then he has another son, whose name is Eliezer. We'll see that in chapter 18. Eliezer means "God is my helper." He is mindful of his God. Okay. Verse 23. Back in Egypt. "Now it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died, and the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. So God heard their groaning. God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them." Here's a lesson for you. Just because we cannot perceive God working, we don't see God working, that doesn't mean he's not. It had been 80 years since chapter 1 to this point. 80 years. And as far as the Jews were concerned, where was God? Asleep. Four times, God heard, God remembered, God saw, God took notice of them. My version says, some of yours will say no or acknowledge, whatever. He's pounding it in over and over again. "I am aware, I know exactly what's going on," is what he's saying here. So, faith, patience, and obedience. Always, no matter what's happening, faith, patience, and obedience. Otherwise, we'll fall into the trap of... Somewhere in the New Testament it says something, there will be mockers who say, "God is not coming." Why do they say that? Looks like God's asleep, 2 Peter chapter 3. So either we're going to have faith, obedience, and patience, or we're going to fall into the other trap. There's one of the two options here. Okay, chapter 3. Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law. What was Moses doing? Shepherding. Interesting. What would Moses do? He would be shepherding. Here's another characteristic or piece of information, if nothing else, about Moses.
Shepherds tend to be heroes throughout the whole Bible. All of the imagery. Well, the angels came down, I think it was Luke, to announce that Christ had been born to shepherds. It's interesting that it's the shepherds. I think this may be the only place in the Bible where shepherds are doing something bad, bullying those women.
Yeah, I understand your point. Although there are a lot of shepherds in Israel who later on will not be the shepherds that they should be, and so God has to chastise them. But you, you're right. So, yeah. Shepherds are esteemed, if you will. So, the priest of Midian, he's shepherding the flock of his father-in-law. And he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. That doesn't mean God lives there. It means that forever from now on, they'll always identify Sinai and Horeb, two mountain peaks of one range, as that's where God was. You remember that. The angel of the Lord appeared to him. We understand that this is God, verse 4, when the Lord saw him, verse 4, God called to him, and verse 6, I am the God of your father. So this angel is God. I don't know how that happens, but that's what this is. There's an angel that appears to him, and this angel starts talking in the first person, I am the Lord, I am God. So, he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. So Moses said, I must turn aside now and see this marvelous sight, why this bush is not burned up. I think I'd say the same thing. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the bush and said, Moses, Moses, and he said, here I am. And then he said, do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet. Anybody ever watch a documentary? Anything on the news? Anything about a Muslim going into a mosque? Barefoot. Buddhists going into a Buddhist temple? Barefoot. Something in the East? Kind of strange for our culture, but not strange for them. The idea is, I'm not going to bring in the filth that I have into your presence. The dirt representing sin. We're not told that explicitly, but that is probably the idea. He also said, verse 6, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Here's the last thing we see for now. He fears the Lord. By the way, what didn't he fear? Or who?
Pharaoh.
Who does he fear? God. There's a passage in the New Testament that says, don't be afraid of those who... This is what he's illustrating. He's living that life right here. Okay. The Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I am aware of their sufferings. So, I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians and to bring them up from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. See, God doesn't leave the job half done. If he had just taken them out of Egypt, that would have been nice, but he had long ago promised them more than just taking them out of Egypt, so God never leaves a job half done. He takes them all the way. Verse 9, behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. Therefore, come now, I will send you. What we have up here, we have all these characteristics of this person. We've got a man on the earth living this way. Here he is. God is going to deliver his people. And what does he say? He takes this guy and says, you are going to be my servant here doing my job on earth. What we see here is this is a person God can use. This is more of a character study than an expositional study so far. Here's a point. You make yourself ready, and the Lord will use you, and I say, in his time. This is what Moses was doing. He had made himself ready. And when God was ready for him, God came down and had a burning bush and said, hey, you're going to go to work for me, and you're going to work for me now. I got a question for you. Moses was called with a burning bush. Bam, burning bush. God spoke to him and said, you're going to work for me. Can you think of anybody else in the Old Testament? God did the same thing. Gideon? You're going to be my, not the burning bush, but God called him directly. You're going to work for me. You're going to go set my free people go. You get the point. In the New Testament, Paul, he's walking down the road. God says, wham, you're working for me. And then, years later, when he's in Antioch, God does it again. Through the Holy Spirit, he says, I'm going to take set aside Barnabas and Saul for me. They got work to do for me. Here's the question. Are Christians today called? Yes. Okay. Interesting.
Not directly like that.
Key word. Say that again.
Not directly.
Not directly like that. Okay. So Christians are called, but not directly. Explain.
I don't believe that God speaks to us. He speaks in our ear or in some way saying, this is what you're going to do. He tells us what we're going to do. It's listed right here in the Bible.
Okay. Turn to 2 Thessalonians. My initial question was, are Christians called? The answer so far has been yes, but not directly. And I would say that that's the biblical answer. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 13, Paul writes to the Christians in Thessalonica, "We should always give thanks to God for you, brethren, beloved by the Lord, because God has chosen you from the beginning for salvation through sanctification by the Spirit and faith in truth." Has God chosen them? Yes. By the Holy Spirit? Yes. To be sanctified? Yes, God has chosen them. Look in the next verse. "It was for this he called you through our gospel." Indirectly. God didn't call up each individual Christian at Thessaloniki and say, "Hey, you, it's time for you to be a servant of mine." We don't have any record of anything like that happening. Here we have these Christians being called indirectly through the gospel. Let me ask you another question. Is anybody in here called to teach? How? Okay, indirectly. Now, some people think, look, the qualifications, I'm not qualified to be a teacher because the Lord has not called me. Is the qualification, can you find in the New Testament, that's the key, in the New Testament, can you find where, other than Paul and a couple others, the qualification is that you must feel directly called from God? 2 Timothy 2:2. Here is the calling. 2 Timothy 2:2. "These things, Timothy, which you have heard from me in the presence of many faithful witnesses, entrust these to faithful men who will be able to teach others also." What's the qualification? Entrust these to men who have had a direct calling from God? No. Faithful men who will be able to teach others also. We were talking about shepherding and being an elder. What's the calling? How do we know that we've been called to be an elder? What are the qualifications? You must feel as though God has given you some feeling or whatever, fill in the blank. We don't read that in the New Testament. The only thing we read of is in, for example, 1 Timothy chapter 3, these qualifications. They must be the husband of one wife, temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not addicted to wine or pugnacious, gentle, peaceable, free from the love of money. He must be one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the church of God? Not a new convert. He will not become conceited or fall, and so that he will not become conceited and fall into condemnation. He must have a good reputation with those outside the church, that he will not fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. Nowhere do we read in the New Testament, if you're going to be an elder, you must have been directly called from God. It is only through, indirectly, through his word, that we are called these ways. By the way, there is one condition of an elder that I didn't state. If any man aspires to the office, it's a fine work he desires to do. So that is a qualification. It doesn't mean that feelings aren't involved. Yes, I want to be an elder. But that feeling was nurtured in myself over many years of preparing myself. Hope that's been a little helpful. Back here in Exodus, in Exodus chapter 3. God had said, I've heard the plight of my children. I'm coming to save them. Moses, I send you. Verse 11, but Moses said to God. And what we understand here is that God's servant isn't perfect. There was only one perfect servant, and the rest have had imperfections. This man is going to have some faults, but what a foundation he has. This is the kind of person God can work with. Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? And he said, certainly I will be with you. This will be a sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. Moses asked, who am I? I'm a nobody. When it comes to doing God's work, it doesn't matter who you are, as long as you've been faithful. All that matters is who God is. He's the one that matters. Verse 13, the first question was, who am I? The second question is, who are you? Moses said to God, behold, I'm going to the sons of Israel. I will say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. They may say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am has sent me to you. God furthermore said to Moses, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial name to all generations. Go and gather the elders together and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I am indeed concerned with you, what has been done to you in Egypt. Okay. Quickly about this I am. And I say quickly because I don't have much to say on it. It's related to the verb to be, from which Jehovah comes from. The word Jehovah comes from the verb to be. This word, when he says, I am who I am, comes from the verb to be. So they're related. That's why he'll go on to say Jehovah a couple times, although in our version it's Lord, because they wouldn't pronounce the name, right? Okay. The meaning, it may simply be I am eternal. I'm just eternal. I am to be. I will be what I will be. Some have supposed that God simply designed to inform Moses that what he had been to his fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, he would also be to him and the Israelites. That God, I'm that God. He who is and who will be what he is. This is different ways of saying the same thing. He never changes, and that's in the tense of the verb. I like this last one especially. I exist in contrast to all the other gods, which don't exist. Because whichever definition is true, and maybe none of these are true, this is certainly true, and so are the rest. They are true, whether or not it's the meaning of Jehovah. I don't have anything else to say on the word Jehovah itself. There's some ambiguity because of the missing consonants and or vowels and all that. Okay. Verse 17. I said, I will bring you up out of the land of affliction, out of the affliction of Egypt, to the land of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite, to a land flowing with milk and honey. They will pay heed to what you say, and you, with the elders of Israel, will come to the king of Egypt, and you will say to him, understand here, God is telling Moses beforehand what is going to happen. There's going to be a long, drawn-out process. It's going to be three things, essentially. Number one, initially they'll believe you. Number two, he is not going to believe you, and I'm going to pound him to smithereens, and then I will let you go. Verse 18, they will pay heed to what you say. That's the first part. You with the elders of Israel will come to the king of Egypt, and you will say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. Now please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not permit you to go except under compulsion. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my miracles, which I shall do in the midst of it. And after that, he will let you go. I will grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and it shall be that when you go, you will not go empty-handed, but every woman shall ask of her neighbor, and every woman who lives in her house, articles of silver, articles of gold, clothing, and you will put them on your sons and your daughters. Thus you will plunder the Egyptians. In other words, when you finally leave, it's going to be no ordinary escape. You're going to walk out there with all that they have. And by the way, you're just going to walk out. You're not going to run out in fear. Okay. chapter 4, verse 1. Then Moses says, and he gives him his third rebuttal, "What if they will not believe me or listen to what I say? For they may say, 'The Lord has not appeared to you.' The Lord said to him, 'What is that in your hand?' And he said, 'A staff.' So he threw it," he said, "throw it on the ground." He threw it on the ground and it became a serpent. Moses fled from it. But the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand and grasp it by its tail." So he stretched out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand. "That they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you." By the way, the question is, will they believe my message? What is God's answer? How does